The best leaders I've seen show a bit of vulnerability. You know, I think it's really powerful when you see a leader just step up and say, hey, look, I got this wrong. And also having the courage to acknowledge the things that were difficult and to say, okay, that has been difficult, but I still think it's the right thing to do. So it doesn't matter if you think you can never get on with whoever it is, country X or country Y. Reality is, you just got to find a way of getting on with them. You've got to find what unites you and not just focus on the differences. And that is like a really fun challenge.
Everything is changing right now. How we live, how we work, how we lead. And if you're a leader, you're probably feeling it. The uncertainty, the pressure, maybe even the exhaustion. I'm Richard Stokes, and this is Mojo Under Fire. This podcast is about those defining moments, the leadership crucibles that either break leaders or forge them into the kind of magnetic forces others actually want to follow. When the old playbook stops working, when you realize you can't work any harder, when something has to change, and that something is you. For the last 5 years, I've been having hundreds of conversations about how people find and keep their mojo, that quality that makes you successful, energetic, influential. But lately, these conversations have gone deeper because the challenges are bigger and the stakes are higher. So in this series, you're going to hear real stories from real leaders about their hardest moments and how they came through them. Not just what happened, but the truth of what it felt like, the approaches that actually worked, and the wisdom they'd share with you if you were sitting across the table from them right now. These are conversations that will give you something you can use, a different way of thinking about your own challenges, tools you can apply, perspective that might shift how you lead, because the best leadership development doesn't come from theory, it comes from learning how someone else navigated the fire and came out stronger. Today's guest is Dr. Alice Bunn. Alice is a globally recognized leader in science and engineering, with a distinguished career spanning strategic leadership, national diplomacy, and public engagement. Awarded an OBE in the Queen's Honours List in 2022 for her services to the UK space sector. Alice is president of the UK Space Trade Association and has a 25-year career spanning space sector, where she's held leadership positions in national, European, and global contexts. Alice is regularly called upon as a media expert contributor to all things space and engineering, appearing on the BBC, Radio 4, ITN, Sky News, and is in demand as a speaker at international summits and conferences such as Davos and TEDx and many, many more. And today, I'm very pleased to say she's on the Mojo podcast. This is a conversation well worth your time. And if it lands with you, do share it with another leader who might need to hear it. Okay, let's dive in. Dr. Alice Bunn, welcome to the Mojo podcast. Great to see you.
You too.
So out of 10, let's get a data point from you. How is your mojo today out of 10?
10, pretty darn high, actually. I would give it a good 9 out of 10. I suspect largely positioned through a brilliant cold water swim yesterday morning and going to Guatemala next week. You're going to have a mojo in these circumstances, right?
All right. So I love that. So there's a couple of things behind that. Tell me a little bit about the importance of the cold water dipping for you and your mojo score.
Yeah, exactly. Cold water swimming is a new thing for me. Like loads of people, I started doing outdoor swimming in COVID because you couldn't do anything else, right? And it was very, very cool and very, very fun. It was also a really wonderfully bonding time for me and my eldest son. And I also chair a charity which teaches kids to swim in developing countries. So big drowning prevention thing. And I have also just signed up to swim the channel next year. So I need to get used to cold water.
My, that's a mic drop moment.
No, not the whole channel. It's part of a team. So it's four.
As like a relay kind of setup.
Yes. It's still really far and cold and dark.
Yeah.
And full of jellyfish.
So I can only guess, and we'll get into this, I'm sure, but the mojo needs to be high to take a challenge like that on, because that's a lot.
Good question. Does your mojo need to be high, or is that the thing you do to get your mojo back up high, you know?
And so, getting into it, so when I say mojo and you gave yourself that 9 out of 10, what does that word mean to you? What comes to mind for you?
Energy. Yeah, energy. In a kind of, you know, positive energy, you know, just being up for it, whatever it is, you know?
Swimming the channel, going to Guatemala, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So, and you didn't hesitate there. You knew exactly what that is. It's about energy, that positive energy. And when, exactly. And when might you notice that that's not in place, then, when it's not there, when mojo is low for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm a bit of an empath. I think it's the people around you, isn't it? So you can go into situations feeling like your mojo is really high. And then if you're instantly surrounded by a lot of negativity, you can just see it plummet. Converse, you know, the reverse is also true, right? You can go into situations where you just find your sparking off people in a really good way. And then that tips your mojo right up again.
Right. Love it. So this is almost the, I've heard it described to me, the drains and the radiators around us. Yeah. Some people just manage to drain that energy and other people radiate energy. And that can be you. You could be doing either of those things, right?
Yeah. And it's really difficult, actually, because what, I mean, in particular for the role I just left, I think they wanted me in that role because I was a radiator, but they knew that I was going to be surrounded by drains. And, you know, so it's like you're put in a particular situation because you're that radiator, but then that can be quite draining on you.
Right. So we bring that energy, that positive energy, into any situation. And, you know, as we speak right now, you are between roles, I guess. You left a big job at the Institute of Mechanical Engineers. The next thing is coming. Tell us, what else would it be useful for people to know about you, to get the most out of this conversation we're about to have about your leadership mojo?
Well, it's funny, actually. We touched on it already, haven't we? It's about the people. I am an engineer. I had a background in science. Lots of different ways. I swim. I'm a mother of four children. I'm blah. But if you look at the career path has always been about people, actually. I haven't followed a technical discipline for a long time now, but I've worked in technical fields and technical sectors. And I think I'm very interested in understanding people and what makes people work well, what motivates people, and alternatively, what you need to look for when things aren't going so well, because that's important too.
Love it. So it's the people's at the heart of what has inspired you in the world of work has been about working around people. And just, I suppose, looking at your list of qualifications, and you are probably the most qualified person I've yet to have on the Mojo podcast.
You want to
including an OBE, including an OBE. But I suppose one might think someone in technology and science, people might not be the first thing that you want to talk about, but you do. So I find that really interesting.
Yeah. And most of the time it should be the first thing you want to talk about. So when I think back over my career, the most rewarding moments have been when you've got people to work together, right? When you've managed to break through people, not understanding that they've got a common cause, viewing themselves as competitors, all that kind of thing. The most rewarding time is when you're able to identify, look, we've all got a shared objective here. We've all got a common goal here. Massively true in space. Because if you aren't sharing, for instance, the cost of the infrastructure, you might be sharing the technical skills that are needed to deliver the infrastructure, and you are always sharing the operating environment. So it doesn't matter if you think you can never get on with whoever it is, country X or country Y. Reality is you just got to find a way of getting on with them. You've got to find what unites you and not just focus on the differences. And that is like a really fun challenge.
And I've just been listening to your Radio 4 documentary, which you presented around celebrating 25 years of the International Space Station. And for me, there was the word that came out of it for me was about collaboration. You know, the whole envisaging of this huge engineering challenge. And as you said, you know, essentially it's Russia, America, plus other countries, but essentially these two superpowers finding a way to work together and, you know, and collaborating and agreeing. Ordinarily, they might not. So what are some of the lessons that we mere mortals who are here on Earth And we're going to the office day in, day out, and we're having trouble collaborating. We're having trouble getting along with our colleagues. What are some of the things that we can learn maybe from that example?
Yeah, it just is about finding your common objective, isn't it? This sounds a bit fickle, but bear with me. It used to make me giggle when the kids were little and you'd see them on the beach, right? And they'd be tearing sheets off each other, fighting nail and tooth over the blue spade or the red bucket. And this would go on, right? And then you'd see a child from another family get closer and they just lock together. Like they instantly find their alliance because they sure as hell weren't going to have another kid from another family steal the blue spade or the red bucket, you know? And it's finding that common cause. So International Space Station is a brilliant example of that. And actually, if you listen to the story, it was the finances that was really the imperative for that, because over that 50-year period, the US and Russian economies variously went up and down, and there was, a couple of significant technical disasters that didn't help much. What's also interesting, we don't cover it very much in the documentary, but is the security relationship, as that played out over that time as well. It used to interest me, back in the day, you'd talk to officials from State Department in the US, and they would describe the International Space Station as a deterrent. So it was a deterrent. It was a helpful way of de-escalating security tensions between US and Russia, because there's this very visible emblem of something that we work together on. And it was really quite neat. It's really quite neat. But I think it's often things that are beyond your control that bring you together. So another thing that I really, really loved working on, in fact, this has got to be right up there in, career most rewarding moments, was when I chaired the disaster charter. So this is a collaboration, a group of space agencies who have come together to share data for helping emergency response in the immediate aftermath of a disaster. So it builds on the principle that loads and loads and loads of countries have got satellites, right? Tons. Communication satellites, surveillance satellites, navigation satellites, and they're all orbiting around the Earth. But if something happens, like, I don't know, volcano, earthquake, flood event,
right,
it's kind of unlikely that your satellite is going to be in the right place at the right time to be able to help you. So the basic principle started off as, I'll share mine if you share yours. Like, bring your assets to the table. If something happens in my territory, then I'll be able to ask you for your data. And in return, you can have mine if it happens to you. And while I was chairing this, we basically pivoted it from, I'll share mine if you share yours basis to a proper humanitarian effort, because we opened up that access to anywhere in the world. So we said, you don't have to have your own assets. You don't have to bring something to the partnership, but if something's happening in your country, you can pick up the bat phone, you can call us, and we will make that data immediately available to you. That was really hard. That was really hard, because everyone's got all sorts of reasons not to want to do that, right?
So I was going to say, perhaps first instinct is, I've got so many reasons why I shouldn't do this, or speaking for the country, versus why I should. So how on earth did you get people to flip that, reframe it, and look at the reasons why we can do it?
Loads and loads and loads of listening. Just loads of listening. And asking very curious questions about what was important, what wasn't important. So, for instance, sometimes there might have been commercial partners. They didn't want to sign up to something like that because they thought, it's going to have an impact on their business. So in that instance, it was about the amount of data that they would be able to provide for free, and arrangements where, for instance, very early on, you could provide the data for free, but then it might pivot over into more commercial arrangement. In other instances, it was more security defense concerns, and they didn't want to be able to provide the data as early as others might have wanted it. So what is sensitive 2 hours after an event is probably not sensitive a day later, right? But still useful for an emergency response effort. You take away any kind of defense tension, but, you know, between 2 hours and a day, you're still going to be able to see whether that bridge is passable, that road is passable, all that stuff. So really trying to understand what it was that mattered. And then you had stuff like, I mean, because it was nuts in a really good way. You know, you had US, Russia, China, India, Japan, Europe, all these people around the table that aren't normally used to collaborating. And it still runs today. It still works today. The one that nearly tripped us up was Taiwan, because that's quite tricky.
Right.
Because you're talking about dealing with a country that one of your partners doesn't even recognize is a country. So it was like, And a lot of it's about face saving as well, isn't it? Like, how do we find a way to keep Taiwan happy in a way that won't embarrass Chinese officials in this instance, describing the premise of the operations? And we used a lot of regional terminology in that instance, but finding a way to help people stay at the table. You know, back to your point earlier about radiators and, you know, and drains. You know, drains score points, drains sit in meetings scoring points, and it's just boring, right? Because you're never actually going to get to working together. And I think, you know, if you really want to get a collaboration off the ground, it has to be really important that everyone looks good. You know, if anyone around the table starts scoring points, then, you know, it's lost.
So it has to be the win-win or the win-win-win, depending on how many parties are involved. That's what you've got to find. And I'm just getting a sense, Alice, from this, you know, I'm loving this, this story and, you know, these breakthroughs with listening and questioning. Also, when you were in that, you know, you personally, did you find, and I'll come back to my word mojo, your word energy, did your mojo and energy need to be like properly high up to keep these kind of conversations going, to keep almost the sense of belief that we can find a breakthrough here, even when everyone is at the moment saying no?
So in that case, it's probably mojo rather than energy, because actually sometimes I think you have to be quite careful and you have to alter your energy levels to meet your audience, right? So I hope self-aware enough to know that I'm quite extrovert, quite high energy, and sometimes that really puts people off, right? Sometimes people don't like that. You know, there's cultures around the world where you just have to dial it back a bit. So it is definitely mojo rather than energy. I think there's also a point where you have to be pretty direct. I'm a great believer in power of plain English. My first proper job, actually, was working at the Science Museum, where we had this brilliant leveller where when we were talking about developing exhibition text, the rule of thumb was, if you can find some words that the average 7-year-old can understand, that will meet the whole population. And this was a very, very useful rule to me later in life, dealing with senior politicians, etc. Because that's the other thing. People, if they're not scoring points, they're trying to be a bit clever. And actually, that doesn't really help. Just be straightforward. Tell people what you mean. Don't try and, again, be clever or embarrass people, because that's not very likely to make them to want to stay at the table.
Yeah. And, you know, in my experience, so much of communication is actually mopping up miscommunication or bad communication. There's so much energy that needs to go into it. We've got completely the wrong end of the stick, because probably someone's coming from a different point of view, a different belief system, a different agenda entirely. And I've said X and you've heard XX. And this is how we've got to here. So hence the mopping up that has to happen.
Although it's interesting, isn't it? In those situations, even that is another form of communication, right? Because it tells you about what they're expecting to hear. So it tells you about their position when they've come to the table for that negotiation. So it's a miscommunication, but it's not lost communication.
I love that. I love that reframe. So there's obviously still value in it, because you've understood more about someone's position. Right. Yeah. Ah, yes. Yeah, that's definitely one to take away. And so we shared a few of these rewarding points in your career. Now, this wouldn't be Mojo Under Fire without getting into some of the times where it's been tougher, where maybe you've gone into a situation, a role even, and come out and had to go through something, you know, tough, and you've come out differently.
Yeah.
What comes to mind for you on that?
Oh, 100% end of 2019. So, like I say, we did loads of work in the space sector in the UK. True then and still true now, actually, is a vast majority of our space missions are through European organisations. So obviously we had that little referendum result, didn't we, back in 2016. And and that put an enormous pressure on our space programs. And you could see, so 2019 was a particular milestone because we were in the run-up to a big European meeting where we were talking about putting new subscriptions on the table. And there was a massive political imperative to say, we're going to do everything completely different. You know, we're moving away from Europe. We're going to do things completely differently. Whilst it wasn't my job to have a political stance, actually, and that's quite hard. I was a definite Remainer, but, you know, that's that. You know, as a civil servant, it's not your job to come with a political outlook. It's your job to come and, you know, deliver the will of government, will of the people. It was also really hard because it just had to be really direct because whilst I recognised that we were going to be doing things differently and we're going to be working in a different way, I absolutely did not want us to do something which would be absolutely damaging for the UK space sector. And there was a lot of hubris, should we use that word? There was a lot of hubris around at the time about the extent to which the UK was going to go it alone and do this and do that. So, yeah, that was difficult. And I definitely had to adjust energy levels. I did not want to bring enthusiasm to the idea that we were going to do all this on our own because we just simply couldn't. And actually, any shift in the way we delivered space programs needs to be on a transitional basis, not a, you know, hard stop. So that was a pretty tough time. When I say pretty tough, I was pretty much camped out in ministerial offices. I'd been booked on 3 planes to go and join this meeting. It was a tough time. A tough time. We got the right result. And it was funny, actually, because I think a lot of it was difficult. And actually, as a leader at that point, I think your instinct is, this is really difficult, so I've got to take it. I've got to take it on my shoulders.
Right.
And I think something that I really reflected on afterwards was something that was quite difficult to hear, which was the team working, you know, to me said, oh, you know, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know what was going on. And as a leader, I thought I was protecting them. And I don't know whether I would have done anything differently. I mean, I would have done something differently, even if it was to explain that I couldn't be quite as transparent as I would normally be about what was going on. But it was a really interesting point of reflection.
There we go. So in this, I've got this real maelstrom of the personal and the professional world kind of clashing, differences of opinion, and you having to hold it all for everybody was a lot.
Yeah.
Right. In that moment. And what, and I appreciate the situation you may not have changed, but what has that given you, you know, maybe the leader you are now to the leader you were then? Was there a lesson? Was there a shift?
I suppose because I was holding it all and I think it was the right thing to hold it all, but actually what would I do differently? What would I reflect on? I would try and be more self-aware about how others were feeling around me and try and, you know, just that message that says, I know this is difficult and I know that you're expecting me to, you know, do X, Y, and Z, but at the moment I can't. I need you just to, you know, trust in me and, you know, be on side. That being more overt about how other people might find the situation difficult.
Right, got it. So that, and I, you know, I love it when you talk about reflection, because I know when, you know, the strongest leaders create points of reflection for themselves. And, you know, part of the point of this series is the opportunity to reflect in public about times that you've had and decisions that you've had. And how have you helped yourself with reflection? Have you made that possible for yourself?
Yeah, good question. I think feedback. Feedback is brilliant, isn't it? Feedback from the people that you're working with. So I know, for instance, that I'm, you know, have a tendency towards optimism. And for the most time, that can have a positive effect and make people feel energized and enthused. At limit, it can all feel a bit Pollyanna and, you know, maybe even irritate. So, you know, for instance, that situation I talked about, I maintained an optimism with the team, whereas actually it would have been more authentic to say, do you know what? I'm really worried about this. No, I'm just going to do my best to try and bring it back, but I'm really worried about it. And that would have probably been more powerful than just keeping the, you know, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. I find, you know, some of these exercises that you can do. One, we did a brilliant one a few years ago with a leadership team. And you did your usual, whatever it is, you know, Myers-Briggs type assessment. So you can see where you are on the Twister mat. And, you know, everyone knows if they're blue or red or yellow or green or all that kind of stuff. It was when you turned it over and looked at the type of behaviours that were likely to be exhibited when you were stressed or overextended. Yeah. And that was, I mean, there were so many eureka moments went off in the room. I remember at the time, I had two colleagues and they were kind of not getting on great. And you could see their behaviours when they were overextended or stressed. One was to go further and further and further and further into the detail. And the other was to detach and go further, 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 further out. And you just looked at it and it's like, no wonder you're not getting on. No wonder you're finding it difficult to work together, because you both have completely opposite reactions to situations of stress on a topic you're supposed to be working together on. So those things are a really nice way, because it's quite kind, isn't it? You don't feel singled out or embarrassed.
Judged.
But everyone's doing that exercise. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everyone's doing that exercise together as a team, I think, is really powerful.
Well, the word, I mean, it came to me earlier when you were speaking, but it's come back to me again. For me, it's around trust that you're creating as the leader of the team to even take them into that exercise, Alice, because they may have been, don't want to do that, don't like doing those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing you created an amount of trust in the team to let's do this and then trust each other to take the conclusions and go and work with them. So how are you... Again, direct question, but how are you creating trust as a leader in organisations?
I lost you then, Richard. Oh. We're going to have to pick that one up again. Something went a bit
crazy. How are you building trust in the teams that you are running to enable them to do processes like that?
Yeah. So I suppose there's lots of things that you do. The best leaders I've seen show a bit of vulnerability. You know, I think it's really powerful when you see a leader just step up and say, hey, look, I got this wrong. I mean, like, not every day, obviously. not to be in total omni-shambles, you know. Oh, I messed up again. But, you know, having the courage to say, look, I got that wrong. And also having the courage to acknowledge the things that were difficult and to say, okay, that has been difficult, but I still think it's the right thing to do because of this and this and this. I mean, funnily enough, in my last role, we had, we went into this pay exercise, right? And I know pay is one of those topics that's quite sensitive, isn't it? And there's me. We went into this pay exercise because I was aware that we hadn't done any benchmarking in the organisation for like years and years and years. And had a sort of intuition that the pay levels weren't quite right. And all, if nothing else, because we hadn't done any benchmarking, it was completely vague with respect to the market. So people were doing the same job and being paid different salaries according to the point at which they entered the organisation. So sure enough, if you look at it in the round, macro round, I was able to get board approval to increase our overall pay bill, because in the round, overall, we weren't offering people a fair wage. And that was fair with respect to the market, but also fair with respect to each other. So it is absolutely true that the majority of people in the organisation were better off as a result of that exercise. But you didn't hear from them. All you heard from were those people who've been, you know, sitting pretty for a number of years now being overpaid, right? So it was really hard to keep the organisation, you know, going along with this exercise because it was for the greater good. And there was a lot of times where I just had to sort of stand up in front of people and just say, look, I'm really, really sorry that you feel that way. I'm really, really sorry if you now feel undervalued and we're going to have to think about ways to restore that. But I am not sorry that we did this exercise. You know, I'm not sorry that we did it in the first place because it was fair. So, you know, that's not quite the same as saying I got it wrong, but it is absolutely acknowledging that, you know, it, things can be difficult for people in different ways.
Yeah, well, I still, you know, you talked about with the vulnerability bit. What I did get there was the courage of convictions of, you know, this process. It's going to be, it's better for most. It's painful for some, and we're still going to do it. It's that that kind of, I think that is courage. I think that's leadership courage to say, I know we're doing the right thing. And as the CEO, the buck stops somewhere, and it probably stops with me. So I want to continue. So yeah, I got a real sense of the courage coming through with that.
Yeah. I mean, it was similar during Brexit stuff as well, because, you know, it's, sorry, massive stereotypical, but a lot of civil service are left-leaning rather than right-leaning. A lot of civil service were Remainers rather than Brexiteers. And actually, you just had to keep pushing people through that and say, no, this is what the public have voted for. This is what we have to do. And even if it's hard, it's our duty to do it.
Yeah. And that's probably some of us, well, you know, a lot of people listening will probably more private sector than public sector.
Yeah.
I guess decisions are made within an organization and you go along with it. Decisions made by the public that you disagree with, that you still have to go along with.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of a bit different, isn't it? But still having to, right, we've got to keep going.
Still having to do it. But then, yeah, a bit, but is it that different? I mean, I think all of us have to live with our conscience, right? And all of us have to decide where our level is and what we're prepared to put up with and what we're not prepared to put up with. And I think, you know, you have to find your level, because if you are doing something that you can't believe in, then that usually shows, I think.
Yeah, well, we're getting into values here, aren't we? The values that
100%.
We have and we hold. And look, I work with a lot of people around the values. Most people in the world of work don't understand them, at least consciously. We kind of know what they are unconsciously. But when you have a good sense of this is what I'm about, these are my values, I think as a decision-making piece, as a North Star, they become incredibly valuable.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to, it's really important. So we have values in the organization. Inclusion was one that was very important to me.
Yes.
You've got to live by them, right? It can't just be glib words. And we were quite tested quite often, actually. Not, inclusion is a tricky one. So I joined an organization which was very traditional. Traditional is the right word. The engineering sector is quite, it's an odd one, isn't it? It's traditional in some ways. It's absolutely cutting edge in others. But certainly the workforce can be quite traditional. So you're living by this inclusion value, but you have to be really careful that your actions, which are meant in the best spirit to include people who hitherto haven't felt very included, women, for instance, ethnic minorities, for instance, but you have to be really careful that you're not accidentally excluding the people that have been included along the way. And just kind of getting that balance is really, really quite tricky.
Yeah. Well, and talk a bit more about that then, because I know inclusion is something you're very passionate about. How did you tread that line between, you know, creating this, yes, sense of inclusion without sort of out-grouping?
Exactly. You have to listen to everyone, don't you? So I suppose, you know, quite a trivial example, but, you know, when I joined the organisation, it was very traditional. We had lots of networking events, but the networking was typically quite formal, sit-down dinners, all that kind of stuff in very formal surroundings that perhaps people earlier on in their careers felt a bit intimidated by, didn't feel very welcomed, a little bit cliquey, and actually wasn't that brilliant as a networking event because you only got a chance to speak to the 8 other people that sat at your table. So we'd do something different, right? We'd shake it up a little bit and have, you know, people just drifting around, have bowl food. You know, you could easily have a conversation with, you know, 20, 30, 40 people in the room that way rather than just the 8. But particularly with some of the, you know, older generations, physically, that might be a bit more challenging, actually, from a point of view of mobility or even from a hearing point of view. You might be in this really awful, noisy environment that made it difficult for them to do their networking. So just like being really careful about listening to lots of different groups and trying to understand the balance. So in the end, we go for a balance, right? We go for, you know, some are done this way, some are done that way. We make sure that we can take every step to make sure that people are, you know, physically included in those kind of networking events. But you have to be sensitive to the fact that the audience is different.
Yeah, and I love that, because when we talked about listening and questioning before, but I think doubling down on it is so important. If you're looking for, I guess, any kind of change, because we're talking about a level of change, organizations are changing all the time, but actually listening to what people need, what they're looking for, without making those big assumptions before making the jump forward.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and it's kind of good old-fashioned tolerance, isn't it? You know, another one we had, and again, tiny example, but we've got a venue hire business, and we accepted a booking from a party that was on the far right of the political spectrum. And lots of people were very, very offended by this and upset by this. And I won't go into the details, and there's lots of reasons why we could have done it differently. But one thing that we probably wouldn't have done differently is refuse their booking just on political grounds. Because if you want to get all kind of, you know, zen-like about it, you know, we wanted to be very, very inclusive and very apolitical. And rejecting a booking on political grounds is in itself an exclusion, right? So you might not like to hear the views, but you shouldn't ignore the views in this particular instance. So there is something about tolerance. There is also then something about being clear. So that was a commercial example, but certainly when we're running the organization, I think there's a time when you really do have to hear everyone's views. You may then need to come down and take a decision, and that's where the courage of leadership, you know, comes, doesn't it, to actually come day one way or the other. But you shouldn't reach that conclusion before you've heard all the views.
Right, love that. So, and have you seen, looking back at your kind of career arc, because I've heard you talk a little bit about leadership style as we've talked, have you seen your style change as you've navigated different challenges and crises and been in different environments? Or has your style kind of stayed, this is pretty much as I am, as I was, as I show up now?
I think we all dial it up and dial it down a bit, don't we? And I think what changes is as you mature through your career, you get to read your audience a bit quicker, a bit better, and you get to understand whether you should be, you know, dialing it up or dialing it down. This is, I keep giggling because I keep thinking of people I've worked with, and I don't think I should really share names on the podcast. But there was a, can I do this? No, I don't think I can. But there was a very well-known brothers who were both politicians, and one was very extrovert. And guess what? One was very introvert, because when you've got a brother like the extrovert, as a matter of sibling differentiation, you absolutely dial down. So being able to act as, you know, to advise both of those different characters, you had to be very aware of your own personal style. I don't know whether any of that was useful because I was talking absolute in tongue.
Everyone's like, political brothers, extrovert, introvert, who are they?
Yeah, so that thing. Yeah, let's get back to the question. That thing. I think you do that more as you go through the career. So you read the situation, you dial it up, you dial it down, you get to know your audience a little bit better.
So I'm hearing like, almost like a confidence thing. I can move from that style to this style as I need to, because I've just been there before, I've experienced this before. Yeah. Is that where it comes from?
Yeah, kind of. And also you can, it's a confidence and a vulnerability as well, isn't it? You can go, you know what, I got that wrong. And I'm sorry I got that wrong, but you don't suddenly feel like that's, you know, the absolute end of your career, you know, that you can bounce back from stuff as well.
And there's another area I wanted to get into, because I know you were a very early adopter of just working in different ways. And what I mean by that is not I'm just either I'm full-time or I'm part-time, but you're doing other things like job share and many, many years ago. I'd love to just hear some of your, you know, your wisdoms around that, because I know it's something that's, you know, as we enter a more fractional age and people are creating portfolio careers and that sort of thing, more and more people are coming into or thinking about. What's some support you can give listeners around that, Alice, from your experiences?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? So I worked for 17 years. I worked either part-time or no time. And in that period, I never once applied for a part-time job because it just went there. So I would apply for the job full-time. And then if I was lucky enough to be offered the job, I would absolutely negotiate my chisel off to end up getting the role. That also applies for the job share stuff. Job share stuff is brilliant. Like job share, I can't advocate for job shares enough. It's like having a work wife. It's absolutely brilliant. Like someone that knows exactly your job and knows all your tricky stakeholders and knows all that kind of stuff.
About trust. There must be so much trust between you and the partner.
Yeah, no, right? Good point. Yeah, good point, because actually your reputation rides on each other as much as it does on, you know, as in yourself. And that's unusual, right? Normally you are responsible for being in charge of how the world views you, and in a job share,
that doesn't
work really well. Yeah, you don't fully have that really. But I would say that early on when I was working part-time, I was doing quite a lot of international travel. I would never advertise the fact that I work part-time. I always thought that would be to my disadvantage. And actually, because I was always traveling, people, if I wasn't around, people assumed I was traveling. They didn't assume I was working part-time. So I would meet people like years into my career and they'd be saying, I never knew you worked part-time. I'm like, you're kidding. Where have you been for 10 years? And particularly true, had to be really mindful of it in different countries. So US, oddly, I mean, wow, they've got an absolutely mind-blowing approach to not really supporting part-time work, certainly not supporting working mothers in any way. I remember being on a panel and I was super humbled because at that point I had just returned back to work having had 5.5 years off when my three eldest children had been young. And they did that thing where they go down the panel, you know, because I was the only non-US member of the panel. And it was women that had 2 weeks off, full-time back to the office, you know, all these different scenarios, but all of them far, far, far more demanding, far more difficult than my situation. And I just felt, I really did feel almost embarrassed to say, hey, 5.5 years off. And again, came back to a part-time job because there wasn't, that I, you know, negotiated for. The job was advertised full-time. There wasn't really anything there. I think what's lovely is now it's not so much a working mother's thing. It's a working parent thing, definitely. But it's also just like you don't have to be a parent. You might just want to do a bit of a portfolio career. You might want to play golf a bit more. You might want to, you know, we're all, I think, a little bit more open to different ways of working. And I think that was true pre-COVID. I think next generation are much less inclined to be, you know, 9 to 5 for life. But I think post-COVID, it has really showed us that we can do things differently if we want to, and we can work in different ways if we want to. And probably some of that comes down to trust as well.
Yeah. And you touched on it just there, and I'd love to get your views on this, because I know you know, very close to the obviously STEM subjects, et cetera, in the UK, thinking about how, you know, kids today are going to work and the jobs that are even going to be there. What advice or wisdom could you bring to that, to someone, maybe they're young listening, or they've got a child at school who's like thinking about what they're going to do?
Yeah, totally. You know,
what do you see?
I'd say the number one message is, jobs now are all about lifelong learning. This idea that we're going to be, taking a job after school and doing the same job for the rest of their lives is absolutely for the birds. There's a stat that always staggers me. So it is said in about 8 to 10 years' time, 85% of the jobs that we will do are unknown today, which is just mind-blowing, right? But then you start to think about, yes, we're however many minutes into the interview, but AI, all that kind of stuff, right? It is changing our jobs. It's changing the way they work. But even more interesting is the fact that in 8 to 10 years, over the same time frame, 80% of the workforce will be the same as it is today, right?
Right.
So right. That argument around lifelong learning, upskilling, reskilling is really, really important. So actually, we all have to be a bit humble, don't we? We all have to be a bit humble about what we do know and what we don't know and how we're going to have to keep learning. So that's probably the main message. And then some good old fashioned stuff, communication skills, reliability is quite important, I think.
Go on, say more about that.
Yeah, well, it relates to the trust point, really.
Absolutely,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
But being where you're gonna be when you say you're gonna be is really, really important. And we must not lose that, because I think increasingly that will be the thing that sets you apart from peers. When you are first starting out in your career.
Wow, and that's a really important call, actually, because I think when we look at trust and things like that, there's an equation for trust, the trust equation, which has credibility, reliability, and intimacy, actually, the things that build it, and then self-orientation takes it away. And often there's assumptions around, I do credibility, I do reliability, but do you? I guess is the question. Are you showing up? Are you, leading with integrity, doing what you said you were going to do? And that's a great call.
Yeah, exactly. And again, back to sort of courage. If you haven't, it's okay to say why you didn't. It's okay to say, I remember at the beginning of the year, I said we were going to do this and this and this, and we haven't. And the reason we haven't is this and this and this. So I'm sorry that I said something that we were going to do, but I want you to understand why I'm doing it differently and why that is better for all of us. And just having that really straightforward conversation.
Yeah. Back to powerful communication and honest communication. Mm. Seems like it's the root of it. Well, Alice, an amazing conversation. Before we end, and we've touched on so many themes in here, but to the leaders listening, what is a key question or a theme that leaders now really need to be thinking about, would you say?
A key question now. I think it is around inclusion. And it is around, what is the key question? Are they really creating environments where they will hear everything they need to hear? Are you really putting in place an environment where you can hear some difficult messages, or at worst, are you just surrounded by sycophants? We used to be, we still are, really, really proud. Ipsos Mori every year does that survey of trusted professions, right?
Yes.
And engineers always come up really, really high. I think we're beaten by nurses typically, but no other sector. Yes. And that is really, really to be proud of.
Mm.
But equally, there's been a few things playing out recently where engineering hasn't been so great, right? You look at the IT sector, you look at the Post Office Horizon scandal, you look at what's happened with Boeing, you look at what happened with the blood poisoning scandal, Grenfell. There were situations where people were warned or people didn't hear the warnings and bad things happened. And for me, that's why inclusion is really, really important, because you've got to create environments where people can speak freely and people can tell you things, even if they're difficult things. And then you can decide what you need to do about them. Much, much better to have that than to be operating under some, glib assumption that all is well.
All is fine. Well, yeah. I love that. And I get this sense of, it's about, part of that is building psychological safety in the organization or in a team that you can share, give feedback, as you've mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, flip side of that is you've got to, people giving the feedback have to do it kindly as well. You know, unfortunately, I've seen situations where people have forewarned of dangers ahead, but frankly, they've done it in such an aggressive, unhelpful way, they've been ignored. So it cuts both ways. You know, the leaders need to keep that ability to listen and to create inclusive environments, but everyone has the responsibility to give those difficult messages kindly, right? Because frankly, you're not going to get listened to otherwise.
Love that. I love that. That sense of responsibility both ways, I think, is so important. Yeah. and often overlooked. You know, it's a thing for you. You're the CEO. You sort it out. But, you know, the rest of the team, what's your role in it as well? Yeah. Wow. Alice, I've so enjoyed our conversation. We've covered a lot of ground. Space, all your experiences, all this wisdom that's come through. Really appreciate your time, and thanks for joining the Mojo podcast today.
Total pleasure. Lovely to be here.